Welcome to Talking History and Happy New Year. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In celebration of the new year, you may be traveling to Las Vegas, one of the entertainment capitals of the world. But in your search for entertainment, you don't have to abandon your interest in history. Las Vegas has a fascinating history, and that is the subject of this week's conversation between Eileen Dugan and Sally Denton, co-author of A History of Las Vegas, appropriately titled The Money and the Power. We will also be hearing from Erica Doss on artistic images of work during the Great Depression. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on January 2, 1882, John D. Rockefeller combined all the components of Standard Oil to form the Standard Oil Trust. It was the nation's first official monopoly, and at the time it was not illegal. Born in 1839, the son of a traveling patent medicine salesman, Rockefeller was a natural leader with a strong work ethic. By his mid-20s, he began to invest in Cleveland oil refineries. In 1870, he formed Standard Oil, rapidly acquiring competitors through price wars, threats, and deceit. And with the support of investment bankers such as J.P. Morgan, he added oil fields, pipelines, and refineries. By 1890, the Standard Oil Trust controlled 90% of the nation's oil refining business. The creation of this monopoly, however, bred distrust. To many Americans, such giant corporations threatened the ideal of the self-made man, striking at the core belief that hard work should be rewarded with success. The first blow was struck in 1890 by the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act. In 1892, Ohio's Supreme Court ordered the splitting of Standard Oil's monopoly, but Rockefeller simply moved his company to New Jersey, where it continued to operate as a monopoly until 1911, when the U.S. Supreme Court finally ruled it illegal.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, in an update on a court case we've been following, a federal appeals court has ruled against a decades-long campaign of the descendants of Samuel Mudd to clear his name. Mudd, a country doctor, was convicted of conspiring in the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. After shooting Lincoln at Ford's Theater the night of April 14, 1865, assassin John Wilkes Booth fractured a leg jumping onto the stage. He nevertheless escaped and made it to Mudd's home, where the doctor set his broken leg and allowed him to rest before continuing to flee. At his trial, Mudd claimed that he did not recognize Booth, who was wearing a fake beard, but the military commission nevertheless convicted Mudd and sentenced him to life imprisonment. He was taken to Fort Jefferson, a bleak island military prison off the coast of Florida. But after serving only 4 years of his sentence, President Andrew Johnson pardoned him for helping battle an outbreak of yellow fever at the prison. His record was never cleared. The three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit cited a technicality in dismissing the latest lawsuit. Judge Harry Edwards said that the law under which the Mudd family sought to have the conspiracy conviction expunged only applied to those who served in the military. Mudd was tried by a military tribunal, but he was a civilian. This is Talking History.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this. I did it my way.
When our thoughts turn to New Year's Eve, we usually start thinking about a place to celebrate the annual ritual. And when we think about places to celebrate, Las Vegas often comes to mind. You may not have included the city's history in your planning, but Eileen Dugan isn't going to let you get away with that. Her guest this week is Sally Denton, the author of A New History of Las Vegas.
Back in 1955, when Las Vegas was still in its youth, Noah Coward had this to say about the city. When I think of this artificial vividness plunked down in the midst of the most primitive part of the world, I have a curious sense of Las Vegas' history. The covered wagon so little a while ago, and now it's all air conditioning and neon. I find a wonderful excess underfoot. Everything, you see, is arranged here. And yet, I suspect, there's a tragic side. This is the impression that many have when they visit the place they call Sin City, or, as the City Fathers would like to call it, America's Place to Play. It's dazzling, it's hypnotic, but there is a sense that something lurks underneath it all. With us today to explore the history of Las Vegas is journalist Sally Denton. Ms. Denton is the co-author of the recent book, The Money and the Power, The Making of Las Vegas and Its Hold on America. Welcome, Ms. Denton.
Thank you.
What inspired you to investigate the history of Las Vegas?
Well, it actually began as kind of a metaphorical study. We were I was raised in a small town outside of Las Vegas and am a fourth-generation Nevadan. And I always knew as a child growing up that there was something more to this city than, you know, met the eye. That there were people, powerful people from all over the world coming there. And I saw it literally rise before my eyes, and from a town of about, you know, 10,000 to a city of a million people now. And but I had been a journalist all over in various parts of the country for about 25 years and an investigative reporter, and it just seemed like every major story that I got involved with always ended up with some tie to Las Vegas. And so I started looking at Las Vegas more as kind of, you know, what is it about this place that represents the rest of the country, and what is it about this place that really symbolizes the values that the country is now kind of worshiping?
And what are those values that you see?
Well, it's really, I mean, Las Vegas is the unvarnished worship of money. And I really watched it, you know, growing up. I watched it slide from kind of the dark side of the American dream, where people came there and, you know, kind of secretly gambled and, you know, drank and smoked and did all the things that they didn't do back home in Iowa. And then it was like the shadow side, and everybody kind of excitedly walked on the dark side briefly for a weekend or whatever. And then to watch it kind of be transformed from the shadow side into the open side, I mean, that Americans came to embrace the values even, I mean, we used to be kind of ashamed of money being so all important in our lives. And there used to be a sense in which you kind of hid that. And then to see the transformation from that as being kind of, you know, seedy to being something that was just kind of widely and roundly sought after in American culture.
How did Las Vegas begin?
Well, it was, I mean, it was just a little railroad stop originally on the way to California. And it was originally, the first settlement was a Mormon settlement. When Brigham Young, who was the head of the Mormon Church, sent some Mormons over to southern Nevada looking for lead ore to use as weapons and for ammunition and weapons in case they were going to go to war with the federal government over the secession of the theocracy. And then it just kind of rose from then and, you know, into just this little desert town. And it really wasn't until gambling became legal in the 1930s that it started taking on a life of its own.
When did organized crime apparently get involved in Las Vegas?
I think they were there from the beginning. I mean, the state of Nevada, the state of Nevada has always been kind of a wide open place, and they had what they called the outfits in various towns. Everybody had, you know, there was wide open gambling and prostitution, and different people controlled it. Well, when they legalized gambling in the state, and Las Vegas became kind of the center of it with the building, the construction of Hoover Dam in the 30s. It was I think that there were some major organized crime figures that saw it as an opportunity from the very beginning, especially after the repeal of Prohibition, when organized crime started moving into different kinds of vice once liquor was then legal again.
And what kinds of vice would you be talking about there?
Well, gambling, prostitution, drug trafficking. You know, there was a huge heroin traffic in the 40s that the early money found its way into Las Vegas gambling casinos, and it's just got a long history of control. Now, our book really kind of charts the rise of this criminal underground, you know, from kind of a loosely affiliated group to something more, you know, what we decided to call it the syndicate, to use one of the definitions that Estes Kefauver, the senator from Tennessee, finally came to conclude. But it was a very all-American, multi-ethnic, I mean, this myth of, you know, a bunch of Italian mafiosi coming in and controlling things is really just that, just a myth.
You mentioned all of these different kinds of vices and problems that were going on there. Didn't the U.S. government take notice?
Well, the U.S. government was very slow to take notice, and it was, I mean, Estes Kefauver was really the first person when he did his hearings in the 1950s and actually stopped in Las Vegas almost as an afterthought. Las Vegas was just beginning at that time, and he was looking at, you know, organized crime influences in other parts of the country. And ironically, congressional committee investigation led to the shutting down of a lot of gambling facilities all over the country, in Kentucky and Ohio and Louisiana, places where it had operated kind of, you know, Little Rock, Arkansas, for a long time. And they shut down and all kind of came to Las Vegas. So ironically, it kind of, the Kefauver committee really kind of spurred the growth of Las Vegas. And then the next real look was, you know, Bobby Kennedy when he was the attorney general. That was probably the first and possibly the last real look at Las Vegas. Every once in a while there's some token, you know, indictment, but it's pretty rare.
How did the type of money behind Las Vegas change over the decades?
I think originally it was the money, the profits from the illegal bootlegging trade during Prohibition that were then reinvested in gambling casinos, and then the profits from the casinos were so enormous immediately that there was what was known as the skim, where you had to, I mean, back in the early days, the state of Nevada didn't even really regulate it, but once they started taxing it in the 1950s, then the casino owners became quite adept at learning how to skim profits off the top so they wouldn't have to report it and be taxed. But the real shift, the original, one of the early shifts, I mean, there have been several shifts in Las Vegas politics and culture, but one of the early shifts was when organized crime started investing in legitimate businesses where they would take the skim off their profits in Las Vegas casinos and drug trafficking all over the country, and then invested in legitimate banks and real estate and hospitals and insurance companies. And before you knew it, they were so intermingled, the funds were so commingled, that it became almost impossible for enforcement officials to, you know, follow the paper trail.
How has the casino business treated women and minorities in general?
Oh, it's probably the worst, one of the worst businesses. I mean, it's a real, it's a company town, writ large, and women rarely, there may be, you know, one woman who's a casino owner at this point, but women rarely, I mean, first of all, they're treated like, as objects in the casinos themselves, as the, you know, cocktail waitresses and the dancers and the, you know, the employees. But as far as a corporate, in the corporate structure, they're almost unheard of, except, you know, possibly in some public relations capacity. But it's not a, and the same with minorities. I mean, Las Vegas was considered the Mississippi of the West. In the early days before the Civil Rights Movement, the black entertainers like Nat King Cole and Sammy Davis Jr. and Ella Fitzgerald, all of the great black entertainers that would come and play at the Sands would have to go and spend the night at on the West Side, which was a very rundown ghetto, still is. And you know, it was not until later that they were even allowed to spend the night in a room at the hotel where they played.
It's very interesting, though, that there are great connections between Mormons and the growth of the casinos. How is that?
Well, that's all. As I mentioned, there was it was originally a Mormon settlement, even though there were only, you know, a couple of handfuls of people there. The relationship between Utah and Nevada is a long-standing and complicated one. They at one point it was all one territory, and the Mormons were the primary inhabitants. After Nevada became a state in 1864, then there really developed a separate culture. But the Mormon influence has always been enormous there and remains so today. And they have gone through, I mean, the money that came from Las Vegas in tithing and investments in the casino business, the money that went from there to the Salt Lake coffers of the Mormon Church is just absolutely astronomical.
How did Las Vegas turn atomic bomb tests into tourist attractions?
I mean, they're geniuses at marketing, obviously, and always have been. But even then, I mean, when no other state in the Union would have even accepted some kind of these kinds of above ground testing like this, except possibly New Mexico, it was rather than scaring people away, they decided to turn it into some great new show. And they would have parties on the rooftops of the casinos where you could see the bomb blast going off in the distance at Area 51 at Mercury, Yucca Flats. And they'd, offer atomic cocktails, and they'd dress the showgirls up with atomic, bathing suits that look like a mushroom cloud, or they'd be riding on rockets. And, I mean, they just turned it into a extravaganza, and shockingly, the people came to watch it.
Now, how has Las Vegas influenced not just local and state elections, but, as you've found, presidential races as well?
Well, there's so much money there. And, as the situation currently with money in politics, national and local, that's just it's a fount of money that couldn't be ignored. And it traditionally, I mean, this goes way back. I mean, we really look at even the 1960 election, and the amounts of money spent then were so minuscule. But the relationships in Vegas became crucial in the 1960 election. The Nixon and Kennedy, and the organized crime ties really on both sides of both candidates, and who was influencing elections and what places, all had kind of traced back to Las Vegas. Well, in this last presidential election, the amounts are staggering that went to both Democrat and Republican candidates on a national level.
We've been talking about the various forms of corruption and vice and such in Las Vegas, and government doesn't seem to have done all that much to stop it. Well, what about the FBI or the CIA?
Well, the CIA, its mandate is not to get involved in domestic affairs, but the FBI has tried, and I mean, there was a celebrated agent who was in Las Vegas in the 1970s and early 80s, and they almost ran him out on a railroad. Most of the FBI agents have taken, they spend their time either, even the special agents in charge, the head of the office, spend their time there for 2 or 3 years working for the FBI, and then inevitably take some six-figure job with the casino industry. And the revolving door between law enforcement and corporate America is, pretty pervasive at this point. And Las Vegas is just a more stark example, as it's a stark example of most things in America. But to leave, where the watchdogs go to work for the people they're supposed to be watching, then, it really compromises the integrity of any enforcement.
We only have a moment remaining, but what do you think of Las Vegas's latest effort to refashion itself? I mean, the family-friendly resorts seem to be going out, and we seem to be returning to the very adult playground.
Well, I think that, as the thesis of the book, that Las Vegas really mirrors the rest of the country, and that it was, the pleasant yuppie days of the 80s and 90s are now kind of over, and the stark reality of the economy and everything else is, it's a tougher world right now, and Las Vegas will always be the first to reflect the new direction. And they'll always do whatever it takes to make money. And I think that the fun family thing was not turning out to be as profitable as they had hoped, and that really Americans are looking for a walk on the wild side.
once again. And who would you say is your favorite Las Vegas character?
Oh, probably Hank Greenspun, who was the publisher of the newspaper there for many years. And he was just kind of a wild and woolly, larger-than-life figure who kind of walked on both sides.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Denton.
Thank you.
Okay, we have been talking with Sally Denton, co-author of the recent book, The Money and the Power, The Making of Las Vegas and Its Hold on America.
Woman, I can remember a woman, warm were her kisses and tender was she, lying there in my arms. Why did you deceive me so? What devil inside made you go when I needed you more?
If you're thinking of traveling to Las Vegas anytime soon, you might first visit the Las Vegas Strip Historical Site. Here to tell you about it is Joey Skidmore.
The Las Vegas Strip Historical Site is a virtual website located on the net at lvstriphistory.com. It provides the most detailed history of the Las Vegas Strip on the Internet. As we just heard, the Strip is a world of its own. Where else can you go to visit Egypt, New York, the tropics, King and Queens, Rome and Greece, and Hollywood, all on one street? This is the street of lights, excitement, dreams, and history. The history of legendary figures like Bugsy Siegel, Howard Hughes, Jay Sarno, and Martin Stern. And legendary casinos and hotels like the Dunes, Caesar's Palace, the Luxor, and Casino Royale. The Las Vegas Strip Historical Site is dedicated to telling their story. As its organizer explains, this is the visionary's site, dedicated to those individuals who looked at 3 miles of desert road and saw a dream, and who in the process of realizing that dream faced resistance and ridicule, and occasionally paid with their lives. Visit the Las Vegas Strip Historical Site at lvstriphistory.com.
And when you actually get to Las Vegas, drop by the Nevada State Museum and Historical Society. Located on Twin Lakes Drive, the Museum and Historical Society's purpose is to advance our understanding of the history of the state of Nevada, as well as its best-known city. This is Talking History.
I walk along the street of sorrow, the boulevard of broken dreams, where gigolo and gigolette can take a kiss without regret, so they forget their broken dreams. You laugh tonight and cry tomorrow.
Carl Sandburg once wrote in his poem, The People, Yes, I am the people, the mob, the crowd, the mass. Do you know that all the great work of the world is done through me? I am the working man, the inventor, the maker of the world's food and clothes. Sandburg was paying tribute to the American worker, reflecting the esteem in which Americans hold the common laborer. But he wrote the poem in 1936, in the midst of the Great Depression, a time in which one quarter of the American people were unemployed. So how did others of the Great Depression view laborers? That's the subject of Erica Doss's commentary. Doss is a professor of art history at the University of Colorado.
In America, a certain reverence for work and faith in the work ethic has played a significant role in shaping self and civic identity from the Republican era of the early 19th century to the present day. Indeed, it is a commonplace assumption that what we do as Americans is often the most outstanding indicator of who we are. Think of how many times you meet someone and the first question they ask is, What do you do? Meaning, what's your job? Where do you work? The meaning of work as a crucial moral link between individuals and public life is so strong that it can almost be considered a calling that ties individual Americans to the larger national community that is the United States of America. Given this perspective, we might assume that American art underscores this national reverence for labor. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, when one in four Americans was out of a job, a vast iconography of labor was made and marketed to the American public, aimed at persuading them to keep the faith in the work ethic. Images of rugged, manly workers dominated New Deal art projects from post office murals to public sculptures. Male American workers became physical icons of national recovery, the body of the worker as an emblem of the well-bodied American economy. That emphasis on the body is problematic, especially as many 1930s images depict partially clad or practically nude American male workers, the worker as beefcake. This might suggest the continuation of aesthetic interest in the ideal human form, mostly male, from the Greco-Roman era to the Renaissance. Realizing work was and remains the key form of masculine identity, 1930s artists depicted workers as muscular, manly bodies in order to ease Depression-era anxieties about unemployment and loss of identity. But nudity has always been a tense issue in American art, and depicting male workers as naked or semi-nude makes them vulnerable as erotic objects of the American gaze. Clothes, after all, signify status and class. Importantly, too, the male most often depicted nude or nearly nude in American art has been the Native American, an act which reduced Indians to the status of bodies and spoke to their marginalization within mainstream American culture and society. In other words, while 1930s artists imaged labor in muscular and virile terms to suggest the strength of working-class men, the representational convention of nudity worked against them. Particularly at a crucial moment when the struggle between labor and capital was at its height, widespread representation of American male workers as objects of erotic desire, rather than as the subjects of their own autonomy and agency, advanced the marginalization of the working class and helped define labor as just a body.
You've been listening to Erica Doss, professor of art history at the University of Colorado. Doss is the author of Benton Pollock and the Politics of Modernism, Spirit Poles and Flying Pigs, Public Art and Cultural Democracy in American Communities, and Elvis Culture, Fans, Faith, and Image. And that's it for another week of Talking History. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau, wishing you a Happy New Year.
Well, since my baby left, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just a lonely baby.